Okay, we're going to begin tonight just with some discussion. I want to throw out a question to you and just encourage us to get into little groups with the people sat next to us. Don't spend too much time moving chairs all about. You'll not be able to get them back in the position they're in now. But just to turn around to the folks next to you and just to discuss this kind of little question. If either you were stopped in the street or if you went out as a reporter into the streets, with a microphone into the streets of Sheffield and ask people, what is your opinion of what's wrong in the world? What kind of response would you get? What are the kind of things that people would say in response to that question? Or what are your thoughts? So why don't we just get in little groups and chat about that for a moment. If someone was stopping in the street, a reporter, and say, what's wrong in the world? How would you answer it? Well, you're really keen to chat, aren't you, to each other tonight? Okay, let's have a little bit of feedback. Anyone want to sort of throw out some of the thoughts, some of the things that have come to your mind, or as you've thought about the answer to that question, or friends of yours, the answer to the question, what's wrong with the world? What's your opinion? What's other people's opinion? What do they say?
Intolerance.
Intolerance teachers. You're sat next to one, yeah.
America.
Intolerance teaches America. Any Americans amongst us tonight? Sure, it's a room there.
Big cities as well.
Big cities, all right. Anyone to add to that? Intolerance teaches America, big cities.
You and me.
You and me. Oh, thank you, Bill. Just me and Bill. You and Bill. And me. We now are America down to George Bush. Right, so America, George W. Bush. That's very specific, over there. You thought greed, right? Okay, greed.
I think that I thought like people have faith in God, so it's like a lot of problems come from that.
A lot of people have faith in God, so problems come from not trusting God and believing God.
Religion.
Religion causes all the wars, they say. What does Stalin, Hitler, Pol Pot all have in common? Atheism, so that causes a few wars too. So good to call that one out. Sorry, Morris dancing. Thank you, Andy. Good one, Morris. Sorry,
male boldness.
They say God made a few perfect heads, and on the rest he put hair. Sorry,
global injustice.
Thanks to Louise for getting about the serious things. Global injustice, that's a serious problem. Yeah,
third world debt.
Pollution,
prejudice,
third world poverty,
terrorism,
crime,
global warming.
Okay, we're getting it. We could go on and on and on, couldn't we? There's a lot of things, aren't there? I want to show a clip from a film. This is Luc Besson's film, starring Bruce Willis, The Fifth Element. And it tells how, in the year 2257, a planet-sized sphere of evil is approaching the Earth at relentless speed. It threatens to exterminate absolutely everything. And there's four ancient stones representing elements of Earth, wind, fire and water are united with this mysterious fifth element. The fifth element turns out to be a perfect human rescuer who actually comes from another part of the universe. But the part we're going to pick up in the film, she's tired and she's weary of fighting. And having briefly seen what human beings have done in history, she does a little word search, a Google word search on war. She wonders whether Earth and humanity ought to be rescued at all. Let's watch. About 6 minutes. So, enjoy.
Thank you. just landed in the desert.
Good job, David. Put on the set.
Where?
Got to figure it out.
This one should be fine.
Do you know how all this works?
Theoretically, yes.
Theoretically?
Now, the four stones should go around. The fifth element should be in the middle. And then the weapon against evil should work.
You've never seen this work before, have you?
No.
The weapon has a manual.
I'm sure this has one, too.
That's it. Match up the symbols. Go, go!
Wind.
Huh? Honey, what you doing?
What?
What you doing?
I'm trying to keep you in the DJ business.
Fire.
So what happens now?
So now we have to open up.
And you know how to do that, right?
Theoretically.
No. Lilo, wake up, buddy. Wake up. You have to help us. Lilo, how do you open these stones?
Wind blows. Fire burns.
Yes, I know, Mother. How do you open these stones? Lilo! What does it mean?
I think that,
Maybe it's a charade.
What?
A game or something.
If we don't get these stones open in 5 minutes, we're all dead.
Dead?
Yes.
Dead.
Lost contact with him.
3 minutes.
I think mine is broken, huh? Well, I gotta get the broke one.
We're never gonna make it. Corbin! Corbin, it moved!
What you doing? Show me what you did!
Nothing.
Show me what you did!
Shut up!
Calm down.
You're showing me. Take it step by step. All right? I was just standing here like this.
Okay?
And I put my hands on the top like this. And I said, we're not going to make it.
That's it.
Oh,
come on,
wind. You said wind. Wind blows. Everyone take a stone. Water for water, fire for fire, earth for earth. Go, now.
Earth. Open the other way.
Okay.
Time for you to work now.
Protect life.
No, Lilo, listen to me. Listen. I know you're very tired. I'll take you on a vacation when we're done. I swear, a real vacation. It's you and me. But listen to me. If you don't do something right now, we're all going to die. You understand?
What's the use of saving life when you see what you do with it?
It'll be entering the atmosphere in 40 seconds.
you do with it? What's the use of saving a life when you see what you do with it? That seems to me one of the great conundrums that God has in the beginning of the Bible, in Genesis 1 through to 11. And it would be the conundrum listening in to all the responses we made a moment ago when we asked the question, what's wrong in the world? And many, in fact, most of the things, if not all of them, were issues and problems that we have made as human beings. And what is the point in rescuing it if we're only going to carry on? As Bill said, we're the problem. What's the point in rescuing a world if it's going to carry on in that sort of a way? So we look in there. Open up the Bible if you've got it in front of you. Genesis chapters 1 and 2. Little picture is going to come up on the screen as well as our Bible overview, God's big picture screen. Picture is going to come up on the screen there. And just to remind ourselves, here in Genesis 1 and 2, God created a world which was very good indeed. And that's repeated all the way through. God saw that it was good. And it culminates, doesn't it, that God looking and he sees everything is made. And it was very good in verse 31 of chapter 1. And so we have this wonderful picture into Genesis chapter 2 of God's people, Adam and Eve, in God's place, the Garden of Eden, under God's rule and receiving his blessing, his presence with them and being blessed by them and receiving the command to live in his ways. But in Genesis chapter 3, we find that humanity rebels against God and against God's rule. And so Adam and Eve, humanity, are rejected from God's presence. And we read in the chapters following on, 4 through to chapter 11, as Matt was sharing with us the other week, humanity spirals into a cycle of rebellion against God and violence against one another. And many of the things we said a moment ago about wrong in the world, it's a rejection of God and a violence towards one another. And so in those chapters of Genesis, we read about God's people. There is no one. No one is God's person. They're outside of that friendship with God now. It's their fall. God's place? They've been banished from God's place. God's rule? Well, God's rule has been replaced with disobedience and the curse. And that's why Christian teachers call it the fall. We fell from a very, very high height to a very low place. And what does God do? Well, will he rescue the world or not? In the words of Luc Besson's heroine, what's the use in saving life when you see what you do with it? And so it is remarkable, isn't it, and surprising that God chose to rescue. He chose to renovate the world that he'd made. And he chose to deal with our rebellion by means of a promise. By means of a promise. And so my first main kind of like heading tonight is God's promise to Eve. Her son will crush Satan and reverse the curse. I just want to clarify and remind us of some things that we've already thought about in our little Bible overview. See, Genesis chapters 1 to 3, I want to suggest to us, it is such a clear statement of the way things are in the world and why they are the way they are, that I reckon that if we come across just Genesis 1 to 3, a portion of the Bible, and nothing else, and we picked it up off the street and read it, we would, no one would think that we were stupid if we thought that that was it. Because it is such a good summary of the way things are. Such a brilliant summary of the way things are between us and our Maker. Between us and one another. Except for verse 15 of Genesis chapter 3, where God says, I'll put enmity between you and the woman, this is to the serpent, between her offspring and between your offspring and hers. He will bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. And it's just a moment there where it's not very clear, but there's going to be a future. There's going to be the rest of the Bible. There's going to be a story unfolding. God promises that a future son of Eve, a human being, will destroy Satan and so reverse the curse of pain and suffering and destruction and death that God had placed humanity and the world under. And so with that in mind, Genesis 1 of 3, that's where Genesis 3 ends. As we move into Genesis chapter 4, what do we expect the subject to be at the beginning of Genesis chapter 4? Sorry? Children of Eve. That's exactly how it starts, isn't it? Eve gives birth to a son. And so there's expectation here. And Eve herself seems to have some high expectations. As she says, now Adam and Eve, the Bible says, now Adam and Eve knew his wife, Eve. They conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced a man with the help of the Lord. There's a real exclamation there of great joy and hope. But the big question is, will Cain crush the serpent? Will he reverse the curse and bring life? Answer, no. He does the opposite. He actually murders his brother and brings more death. And if you follow his line down, you look at his grandson, verses 23 and 24, you find that Cain's offspring get worse and worse and worse, right down to this guy called Lamech, who looks back to his ancestor Cain and says, Cain, they've killed one man, but I'm rejoicing, I've killed 70. Things get worse. Violence against violent human beings being violent against one another. And so the big question is, well, will it be Seth, Eve's third son? Chapter 4, verse 25. Well, no, he and all his descendants remain under God's curse. They also die. And as Matt said, death is emphasized all the way through that genealogy in Genesis chapter 5. They keep on being told, so-and-so died. He lived and then he died. And then he died and then he died. Enoch, one man stands out. Look at verse 24 and 25. He doesn't die. He walks with God and then he goes. God takes him away. So suddenly there's a glimmer of hope. It is possible to reverse the curse. Because Enoch didn't die. And then we're back to death, following death, as the roll call carries on. For a moment, Noah could be the curse reverser in chapters 6 to 9. And you'll notice that the story of Noah actually sits in the genealogy, in all these names. And so will it be Noah? Well, Noah does a fantastic bit of a rescue, but at the end of it all, we find that he gets drunk, and he also dies. So, no, it wasn't him. And that's where we head on into chapters 9 and into chapter 10. And it's just striking, though, although Genesis in these early chapters keeps on emphasizing death, it also, from Eve's first son Cain and her excitement there, keeps on emphasizing life and birth. It keeps on looking for the one who will be born. It keeps on looking for Eve's offspring. And so as we look into chapter 10, there's a repeated line, so-and-so fathered so-and-so, X fathered Y. So the search for the one specific son of Eve goes on. But it comes to a shuddering stop in Genesis chapter 12 with a man called Abram, which literally means father. Abram means father. And ironically and painfully, after all these men who have fathered the next son, who then fathers the next, he's the first man, and he stands out painfully, ironically. He's called Abram, but he's the first man who hasn't fathered a child. And when we are introduced to him, he's already a very old man. And so suddenly the promises of God are hanging by a thread. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? Well, we're going to have our readings now. And who's reading for us? I think Phil's going to read a reading. Nicola going to come and read Genesis 12 and section Genesis 17. So to you two. Thanks.
Right, the first one is on page 10. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abram went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran, and Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran. And they set out for the land of Canaan. When they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. And at that time the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built there an altar to the Lord, who had appeared to him. From there he moved to the hill country, on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed on, still going towards the Negev.
Genesis 17:1-14. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, "I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you, and may multiply you greatly." Then Abram fell on his face, and God said to him, "Behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you, and your offspring, after you throughout their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be your God to you, and to your offspring after you. And I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." And God said to Abraham, "As for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised. Every male throughout your generations, whether born in your house or bought with your money from any foreigner who is not of your offspring, both he who is born in your house and he who is bought with your money shall surely be circumcised. So shall my covenant be in your flesh, an everlasting covenant. Any uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant."
Well, we've looked and been reminded of God's promise to Eve that one day one of her offspring will come and would reverse the curse, crush Satan, crush the enemy, and bring life. And we trail through the Bible looking for this particular offspring, and we then come at this point to this fellow called Abram, father, but he's unable to have children. What's more, he's already old. But it's through this man, Abram, a childless old man, that God's promises to Eve will ultimately go on to be fulfilled. And so my second main heading is God's promise to Abraham, a people, a place, and a blessing, which is the three things that we're using to summarize the whole Bible as we go through it. And God specifically promises these things to Abraham on three separate occasions. We had two of them read, but there's also in Genesis chapter 15 as well, where it's also reiterated. So turn to Genesis 15 and let me read some words from there. And it does add a little bit more. It's not just a repetition of those other moments. But after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Abram's worried, he's concerned, he's having sleepless nights, and he's thinking, well, you know, where's this promise going to come from? And I'm an old man. My wife Sarah's an old woman. Where are we going to have a children? And, you know, how's it going to happen? And so God comes and says to him, "Fear not, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great." But Abram said, "Oh, Lord God, what will you give me? For I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus." And Abram said, "Behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir." And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, "This man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir." And he brought him outside and said, look towards heaven and number the stars if you're able to number them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And Abraham believed the Lord and he counted it to him as righteous. So here's this old guy, can't have children. God takes him out on a starry, starry night and says, look at the star, you're going to have that many children. Well, and what are we told in verse 6? He believes God. He trusts God's promise at that particular point. So we'll flick between Genesis 12, Genesis 15, and Genesis 17, and we're not going to go into too much detail, but just get a full feel of the promises that God makes. God promises not only that this childless old man will have a son, but firstly that he will have a people. That's the first part of the promise. He will have a people. His descendants will grow in number to be a great nation. 12 verse 2, look at that. God says, I will make you a great nation. And then turn over to chapter 15 and verse 5. God says to him, look towards heaven and number the stars, if you're able to number them. So shall your offspring be. So great a number will be this people, says God, we'd better change your name. Look on to chapter 17 and verse 5. We'll change your name from Abram, father, to Abraham, which means father of many. So God's promise to Abraham is that he will have a people. And Abraham's descendants will be God's people. So stay in chapter 17 for a moment. Look on at verse 7. God says, I will establish my covenant between me and you, and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your people, your offspring after you. And as a mark of that, the boys were going to be circumcised as a sign that they were in that very special friendship with God. They'd come in to be God's people. Not because they were good, but because their father had received the promise and trusted it. And so there's this great phrase which is often repeated throughout the Bible. I will be your God and you will be my people. So we can already begin to see that the curse is going to be reversed. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, chucked out, no longer God's people. Well, here's the promise that one day God will have a people and it will come through Abraham. Secondly, God promises Abram, whom ironically he calls to be a wandering refugee. He promises him a place. So turn back to chapter 12 and verse 1. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land I will show you. God promises that he will have a land, a place that will be his and his people's after him. But it's not any old place, it's the promised land. And many of the metaphors and the imagery that the Bible begins to use speak of a beautiful land that is supposed to ring bells in our minds and remind us of Eden, a land flowing with milk and honey and all those wonderful descriptions of this rich and fertile land. And so turn on to chapter 17, verse 8. God says, I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojourning. He's going to be a wanderer in it for a while, but it will become his people's. All the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. So God promises Abram a people, and he promises him a place. Thirdly, God promises a blessing. He promises to bless Abraham's descendants. And that is to reverse the curse. Blessing, curse. Humanity has been cursed, and God promises to reverse, to bless Abraham, to bless his people, but not just his people, through them to actually bless the whole world. And so back to chapter 12, verse 3, God says, I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, Abraham, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And so through Abraham's descendants, God will bless everybody, everywhere, all people, everywhere. And so from the very start, God's plan to reverse the curse is absolutely universal. It's not sort of racial. It's for everybody. And so just a living and alive illustration. I was going to be speaking to you this evening in my Welsh rugby shirt, but my wife wouldn't let me. She said, you might turn some people off. So my little son was very helpful indeed, and without his mum knowing, he sneaked his little bag And he came out of the house with it, even though she said, oh, you better not take that to church. And he said, oh, I got to. And in it is my rugby shirt. So there it is. I won't be wearing it. But there's some super photographs in the newspaper today, which I absolutely love. You know, there's this one here. It says, Dragons on Fire, Wales Send England Packing. With Fighting 11-9 with Pages. So there we go. A fantastic picture of them at the end of the match, all jumping about in their red shirts. And here we go. Look at that fantastic shot there of the hero of the hour. He can kick a ball better than any Englishman, that Welshman can. And did you see him do them two tackles on that boy playing for England for the first time? Got a picture here of that. Twice he grabbed him with one arm and just picked him up and then put him down quite gently. It's a fantastic game. Thoroughly enjoyed watching it. But the reason why Tanya said, well, you know, you might turn some people off, you know. In reality, Wales is second, isn't it, really? God's promises for everybody. And as people come into God's family, doesn't matter what colour we are, doesn't matter what race we're from, what language we speak, what shirt we'd wear if we were good enough to play for a country, God's promises for absolutely every single one of us. And so it's particularly good, isn't it? We didn't know that Asif and Claire were going to be here when we were planning through this series. But it's fantastic, isn't it, to have someone amongst us from Pakistan who is spending and giving his life to evangelizing and reaching out to Muslims. Because this promise, through Abraham, that culminates in Christ, is for everybody. For people, for what doesn't matter what their religion is, the call is to come and to receive the promises of God. So there's a great promise, isn't it, to bless absolutely everybody in the whole world. God mercifully promises to reverse the effects of the fall, just as God created Adam and Eve, placed them in a special land and blessed them. God promised to create a new people, to put them in a special land and bless them. God's people in God's place under God's rule. The promise to Abraham really actually becomes the backbone of the rest of the Bible. As I've used the phrase before, the melodic line in the Bible's music. Or if you put it this way, the track on which the train of God's history runs is this great promise. To Abraham and his descendants, and through them, and through one specific descendant, to the whole world. And so let's come back to our diagram. I've been given one of these by our one of these things that does little red dots, look. Because if someone was here that evening and I was using Matt, the drummer's little drumming stick, and they thought I'd be better with one of these. So here we are. Look at that. There's creation and the fall at the very start, God's people in God's place under God's rule, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, they rebel against God, and they're rejected from the garden, rejected from God's place, no longer in fellowship. And you realize, remember at the very end of Genesis 3, there's an angel who stands at the gate of the garden, and there's no way back in. And yet God comes mercifully and kindly. Although in that film we saw earlier on, the big question is, well, you know, if you were God, would you rescue this lot? Well, God does. Mercifully, he comes in and he makes his promise to Abraham, where he's promised a kingdom. God's people, Abraham's descendants, God's place, the land of Canaan, God's rule and blessing on Abraham's descendants and all the nations. It's just striking, actually, that God's rule and God's blessing actually become words that you use very, very closely throughout the rest of the Bible. We often think that to obey and live under God's rule is not really a fun way of living and not really a blessed way of living. But the Bible actually says if you live God's way, it is actually a rich and a deep blessing. And those two things come together. And that's how we're going to follow things through. We'll see the little chart going up like that. Through the promises, through the Bible overview as we go on from here. Okay, let's come back to my third point, final point, and quite briefly. We looked at God's promises to Eve, God's promise to Eve, God's promise to Abraham, how is it relevant to us? God's promise and us. is my third and final title. Firstly, I think as we think and we reflect upon the way that God came to Abraham and promised these things to him, I think there's two or three things that we can take home. First of all, I think we realize that only God can initiate our rescue. Only God can initiate our rescue. I mean, that's what the very heart of it being a promise. God comes and he initiates something and he tells us something that we have to rely upon. It has to come from him. Only God can initiate our rescue. At the end of Genesis 3, like I said, humanity is thrown out of God's presence. An angel with a flaming sword is placed at the gate. The angel stands as a sort of impenetrable, no entry sign. There's no way for any human being to enter into God's presence, let alone be a part of his people again. The only way is if, we put it this way, God takes the initiative himself and comes out of the garden. That's the only thing that's going to happen. We can't get back in. It's only going to happen if God comes out and takes the initiative. Well, that's what he does in the promise to Abraham. I think it's a very, very simple thing that I think we need to take home here. If we're Christians or if you're not yet a Christian, this is a good thing for us. Good challenge to the way that we think. See, more often than not, when a Christian tells the story of how they were converted, we speak sometimes of the moment when I invited God into my life, into my story. Whereas as we go through the Bible and have a Bible overview and see the reality of the situation, we actually really ought to say and talk about the day, not when I invited God into my story, but when I realised God was inviting me into his story. That's the way it ought to be. God-centred, not us-centred. It's not our initiative at all. We're totally dependent upon him coming and inviting us in. And so if we are Christians, I think we need to think that way. If you're not yet a Christian, then there's a call for us to actually be humble before God and say, please God, if it's not entirely up to me here, I really do need you to do something for me. It leads to humility and dependence upon God. That's the first thing. And secondly, only by trusting God's promises are we put right with God. Only by trusting God's promise are we put right with God. How do we get right with God? Not by what we do, but by trusting God's promise. Abraham was the first person to whom God clearly said, you and your people will be my people, and you will be in my place and under my rule in receiving my blessing. And together we will show the world how good it is to have God as your God. And he was the first person to whom that was said with great clarity. And it became true for Abraham, not on account of his goodness, but simply because he took God's word for it. So look at Genesis chapter 15 and verse 6 again. It says this, he believed the Lord and God counted it to him as righteousness. So basically he was met righteousness, that word, he was made right with God simply because he trusted the promise. He believed God, and there was so much against it, wasn't there? I mean, there's so much against him, this promise ever coming true. He was an old man, Sarah was an older woman, and they had already had 100 years, centuries of struggling to have children. I mean, it's an unbelievable promise. God takes him out from his tent and shows him the stars in the sky, and one day all your children are going to number that many. Well, he takes God simply at his word. And so God says, you're righteous because you trusted my promise. See, God initiates our rescue. And it's only as we trust God's promise that we really are rescued as we depend upon him. The third implication, ultimately God initiates and promises to rescue us through Jesus Christ. So let's leave the Old Testament behind and fast track all the way through to 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 20. That's on page 1160. Page 1160. and I won't spend too much time on this at all, but it's just simply this. As Paul, writing to these Corinthian Christians, he says of the Old Testament and all the promises of God, he says, "For all the promises of God find their yes in Jesus, in him. That is why it is through him that we utter our amen to God for his glory." So that little phrase, "For all the promises of God find their yes in Jesus." And so as we think about being in a right relationship with God, being made right with God, being one of God's people, with the promise of ultimately entering God's place, heaven, which is often for us as hard as it is to believe that, as it was for Abraham to believe he was going to have children that numbered the stars of the sky. If we're going to be in that place, then ultimately the promise comes through Jesus. We're going to be God's people in God's place, living with his blessing and under his rule. And it's only in Jesus Christ. I'm going to end by showing another little clip. And this is a film which I think quite a few people have seen, but not all of you have seen. It's The Passion of the Christ. And there are a lot of things that I'm a bit uncomfortable with this film. I've seen it a couple of times. But I think the little bit we're going to see is amongst the best parts of the film. It is an 18 certificate, but none of the scenes we're going to show have anything brutal in it, okay? But it's a great moment in the Garden of Gethsemane where it draws out God's promises right from Genesis and sees them fulfilled in Jesus. And I think Mel Gibson does something here which is really rather good.
Him. at the night. No way, not till Hawk and Manny.
Corinthians 2, for all the promises of God find their yes in him, in Jesus, the one who was promised to Eve, crushed Satan's head. And Mel Gibson depicts it really rather well there.